Tango Tango Popple 1684, September 16, 2012.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Gordonsville, Virginia. needless to say, I've been pretty busy the past few days, and as a result, I really haven't had a time to even think about recording a podcast, really, so I'm not going to push myself, so I didn't do it. So anyway, in the last podcast, I was talking about possibly getting a new phone, and so I did. I ended up going ahead and pulling the trigger on a new phone. So what I ended up getting, I waited until the Apple announcement, whenever that was, I don't know, 2 or 3 days ago. Waited until the day of the Apple announcement, and I found out that pretty much everything about the new iPhone 5 had already leaked out. Everything that had leaked out prior had turned out to be pretty much true. And so before that, I kind of figured all that was true, and so that kind of confirmed it when they had their event. So I was already leaning towards the Samsung Galaxy S3, and so I went ahead and I was able to get one of those. Those have been on sale. I don't know. I think that came out probably at the beginning of the summer, and so that's already widely available everywhere. So I was able to. I was in Council Bluffs, Iowa. So I was able to get a Galaxy 16 gigabyte version of the Galaxy S3 at a Best Buy store there. There's a TA truck stop, or there's a couple of truck stops in Council Bluffs, but there's a TA. There's actually three truck stops, but there's a TA truck stop, and at the same exit, there is. It's about, I don't know, 2 or 3 block walk across this big. Park, you know, where you have to cross the street, you know, pretty good sized street, and then there's this big shopping area that covers quite a bit of space, and that's the Best Buy store is back in there in the corner, and so it's about a 2 to 3 block walk from the truck stop altogether, probably. So I was able to park in the truck stop and then walk across the street into that shopping center and to go to the Best Buy, and went ahead and got the Galaxy S3. And so while I was there at the Best Buy, I went ahead and I was able to use their Wi-Fi while I was there. After they activated the phone, I went ahead and went through and downloaded kind of all the apps the apps that were on my old phone, kind of went through those and downloaded the ones that I wanted on the new phone. So got all that done, and that took a couple of hours, actually, you know, to kind of go through. You don't realize the stuff that you put on your phone today. And of course, a smartphone is a computer, and it's actually a pretty powerful computer. And you're doing quite a bit of customizing, just as much customizing that you do on a desktop or a laptop computer. You're really kind of customizing the thing. You're putting your data in there and your apps and what have you. Now, Google has it set up pretty well. The Android is set up very well. All you have to do to get your contacts into the phone is you put in your Google username and password. So you basically put in your Google identity, and if you've already had a if you've already had an Android phone, all of that stuff just kind of magically comes in from the cloud, the quote-unquote the cloud. And so all that stuff comes in. So all the context came in. Now, the apps don't come in. The Google Store, the App Store, remembers what you have. If you've purchased something, it remembers it. But you actually, unless there's something I'm missing, you actually have to go in and kind of tell it, I want this and I want that, and so on and so forth. So got all that done, and then I walked back over toward to the truck stop. But on the way, there was a Cracker Barrel restaurant, so I ate in the Cracker Barrel. And then I went ahead and walked back over to the truck, and it's kind of funny. I guess I'm not used to walking. So, you know, I might be a little bit low on potassium. I'm not sure about what happened. But anyway, I went ahead and went to bed. And there have been times when I go to bed and, I'll move my leg wrong or whatever, and I'll end up with a cramp, Charlie horse. And, but this time, and of course the cure is always you just stand up on it, and the Charlie horse, kind of stretches the muscle out, and the Charlie horse goes away. Well, in this case, it happened on the front, kind of the muscle that's on the, the front, outside. It happened on my left leg first. It's kind of in the front, on the shins, but it's on the left side and left leg. And that the problem is that, I've never had a Charlie horse or a cramp there in that particular muscle. And the problem is that there's not a whole lot you can do about it. You can't really, standing down on it doesn't do anything, and really trying to flex it just kind of seems to maybe make it worse. So so that happened, and I don't know, it went away. I was trying to massage it to get it to, try to get it to go away, and it after a few minutes it went away. And then I'll be darned, I went ahead and laid down, and ended up just moving it, twitching it just a little bit, and it started all over again. And then I must have moved the other side, the other leg, and the same exact thing happened in my right leg at the same time. So that went on for, I don't know, probably 10 or 15 minutes, and then it's kind of funny. It wasn't funny at the time, but after a while, I was able to kind of, get that to go away, and then I was able to sleep. But it's been a couple of days now, and those are actually, it's still sore a little bit. Both legs, in the front, on the out, kind of the outside, on the right leg, it's on the kind of the right front area, in the shin area, and then the left leg, the left shin area, that's still just a little bit sore. But so I've eaten some bananas, and so hopefully that will that'll take care of whatever, so hopefully that won't happen again. But I don't walk that much, and I don't know what happened. There are times when I've got to park in a truck stop, and I have to walk quite a ways to get inside the truck stop from the truck parking lot. So I'm not exactly sure what happened. I was probably just low on potassium or whatever. But that's the first time I've ever had a cramp where, in that case, you can't really stretch it out. Now, I have had, there's been times, hasn't happened for several years, but I have had neck cramps before, and those can be kind of miserable. You know, in a case of neck cramps, the only way you're going to really get those to kind of go away is if you can take some sort of Darvocet or, you know, some sort of a muscle relaxant. Now, I don't know if I even, don't even know if I have any Darvocet with me. It's been years since I've had any kind of neck cramp or neck problems at all. So, but in any case, I didn't know, you know, if you ever get a cramp, you know, that on the shin, you know, on those shin muscles, there's not a whole lot you can do until the cramp's just going to have to go away. Because you can't, like I say, you can't really just stand on it and make it go away. So, so in any case, I'm happy, pretty happy with the new phone. I was able to, of course, before I got that, I went ahead and there I got a podcast application called Beyond Pod that I paid for. And to make, you know, on the old phone, to make sure that it would be functional, that it would work, that I could use the phone as a podcast aggregator, and I could. And so I put the Beyond Pod on the new phone, and that part of it's working just fine. I'm using that as the aggregator as well as the playback device. One of the reasons, there's a couple of reasons why I got, you know, I really lean towards getting the Galaxy S3 as opposed to the iPhone 5. One of them being the screen size on the iPhone 5 is 4 inches. And so it's, you know, instead of, I don't know, Apple just wanted to make a 4-inch screen. And so they didn't really, as I understand it, it's not any wider than the existing iPhone or iPod screen. Those are 3.5-inch screen. So it, they made it, the screen is actually somewhat longer, and it makes it into a 16:9 aspect ratio. Instead of, you know, they could have made it bigger, but I guess they didn't want to make the thing any wider or whatever. Because, you know, they've got their, you know, it's Apple, and, you know, they've got this imprint from Steve Jobs that, you know, they know best. So I wanted a screen, you know, that Evo that I have is a 4.2-inch screen, and I wanted a screen at least as large as what I had for the past two and a half years. You know, I've had a 4.2-inch screen for 2.5 years. Why? I don't want to go backwards. And so this Galaxy S3 is a 4.8-inch screen. And it's an AMOLED or AMOLED. So it's a high-definition screen, very bright, sharp, great colors, really great saturation. And, you know, for the screen. And so I'm really happy with the screen. Really very readable. So, the screen size was one thing. And then the other thing that really kind of helped sway me towards the Galaxy S3 is the battery issue. You can easily take the back of the S3, you can take the back off and get at the battery. And, you know, the user can replace the battery. Or you can actually get a bigger battery from Amazon. There are people that are selling bigger batteries, and you could actually and it's got good battery life as it is, but you could actually, if you wanted to, you could even, you know, probably double the battery life and make it having just extremely good battery life if you wanted to, beyond what it has. So and what it has right now, you know, it pretty much matches the iPhone. And this is with the LTE, the 4G LTE, and it sort of remains to be seen once people actually get their hands on the new iPhone 5 that has LTE. It remains to be seen what the battery life with that, with 4G, with the true 4G is going to be. Because up till now, the iPhone 4S and below, it's just 3G. So it kind of remains to be seen if Apple is going to be able to match the Galaxy S3. you know, as far as battery performance goes. So those are the two main reasons, the things that kind of swung me towards the Galaxy S3. And so I'm very happy with it. Very happy with the screen size, very happy with the device itself. It's very solid, really rugged device, and it's an amazing piece of hardware. And then, of course, you can take the back off and look, you know, you can see where the battery, you know, where the battery is. You can actually see where, you know, the kind of the guts of the phone are sort of sealed. You know, the guts of the phone don't really take up that much room. It's rather amazing, you know, look in the back of that thing. The guts of the phone are sort of sealed in metal, and you can see where they're at, and there's really, you know, it's amazing how much they've been able to shrink that stuff. So, but I think, you know, hardware-wise, it pretty much matches the iPhone, you know, spec-wise, the cameras and so on and so forth. So, again, I'm very happy with the Galaxy S3, and you know, I'm happy with my choice, and it's overall, it's really quite an amazing piece of hardware, and I really don't, you know, the Apple, I don't know, I think, I'm really beginning to think Apple has kind of, you know, without Steve Jobs, it's Apple is going to fall apart. And there, you know, the problem with Steve Jobs had some real quirks to his personality. He had some real faults, personality faults. But in spite of that, in spite of those faults, he was successful. He was able to, the positive things that he came up with, you know, as far as the innovations go, sort of outweighed the negative aspects of his personality and his personality quirks. Well, now the problem, now that he's gone, he's not there to, you know, kind of direct them anymore, obviously. And so, you know, he may have left, you know, they said, well, he left 5 years worth of products or whatever, or 5 years worth of innovations. Well, that remains to be seen. But the tendency is going to be for them, you know, the company was really imprinted with his personality, including the personality quirks. Now, the tendency is going to be for those people to think that the personality quirks were what made him successful. Were the personality quirks were the innovations? Well, they're not. He was successful in spite of the quirks. You know, he had this idea that he knew better than the customer what the customer needed. And so Apple, you know, that philosophy is still there. They think that they know best. And it's causing them problems. You know, they're still, you know, the thing, there's all this momentum that's going on, you know, and so I think they've gone over the cliff, but because of the momentum, nobody realizes it yet. So I think it's just a matter of time before they're going to not be able to continue to innovate. They're not, you know, because with the, you know, Android, you know, you've had bigger screens and so on and so forth. And Apple with this iPhone 5 is just now kind of catching up to the Android phones, the Android hardware. They're just now catching up. And so that does not portend well for their future. Then the other thing is this, you know, the sealed battery thing in their laptops. Now, I can understand maybe you do it in an iPad or something, and I really don't understand it there. And I certainly don't understand it in a phone. But when you get to a laptop computer and you're sealing the battery in there and you're making the thing, like with these new MacBook Pros, they're virtually not non-repairable. and you're charging, you know, a huge premium from a hardware perspective, above and beyond what the competition charges, and you're making them throw away. They might as well be like a throwaway Bic pen or a throwaway Bic lighter, but you're charging a huge, you know, big premium, high-end price for it. Something not right about that. Now, their products, at this point, their products don't excite me anymore. So I have Apple products. I'm recording this right now on this 17-inch MacBook Pro that I've had for at least four years or maybe longer. And it's been repaired. I've taken it in to get repaired a couple of times. It's got a battery that like a normal laptop on the bottom, you just release it and you get the battery out and you can put another one in there. I've replaced the battery once, but I've had it worked on a couple of times, and it can be worked on. That people are able to take it apart and replace whatever parts and fix it. So it's extremely repairable, so I have no intention of replacing it anytime soon. You know, there's no need to. And that was one of the best things about Apple products for a long time, was that they gave you pretty good value. You could buy an Apple computer, and even though it was probably more expensive than the competition for matching hardware, you could use the Apple computer would be usable for far longer, because it would the software wouldn't get all gunked up, and you could actually replace things. And you know, but the biggest thing was the software, the operating system. So now they, with these new MacBook Pros, they just want you to buy it and then, well, just throw it away, get another one. You know, that's they're trying to, you know, and I just don't see myself doing that. You know, so I've bought some Apple products, don't see myself buying any more, at least anytime soon. And then the other thing with this iPhone 5, of course, then they're going to be spreading to iPads and so on and so forth, is the dock issue, you know, that connector. You know, instead of having the typical Apple, you know, 30-pin connector, or however many pins it has, the flat connector, now they've gone to this other connector. It's a smaller connector, and it's incompatible with, you know, there's been millions and millions of docks sold, iPod docks. You know, various devices, speaker systems, iPod docks in cars, etc., etc. Now, all of a sudden, oh, well, we're going to change that. All that stuff, it won't work anymore. Too bad. Have to buy new stuff. You know, I think that's stupid. I think it's really stupid. You know, they can do it. It's kind of like Netflix. Here a while back, remember Netflix, you know, well, we're gonna get out of the DVD business. So we're going to spin this off, and it's going to be called Quickster, and you're going to have two different accounts that you're going to have to deal with. And, you know, they could do that maybe when they were a little tiny company. A little tiny company can turn on a dime like that and just arbitrarily change everything, and it's not that big of a deal. But when you get to be a big company and you know, and there's millions of things that rely on the design that you've already established, then all of a sudden you just arbitrarily change it. It doesn't work. That's what's been the noose around Microsoft's neck for years. With Windows has been that you know, with such a huge percentage of the computer. Desktop computer business running Windows, especially business stuff, they couldn't just arbitrarily change the operating system and make it more secure. They couldn't change it. They couldn't change the architecture of the operating system very much, because businesses had spent millions and millions and millions of dollars on custom software. And that software had to remain compatible. They had to be able to run it. And so if you changed the Windows too much, that old software wouldn't run on it. And so Microsoft had all this legacy stuff that they had to remain compatible with. And that caused him a, you know, just endless amount of grief. And had they come up with a version of Windows that was just totally incompatible with what had, you know, with the software that would run on it before, people would have, you know, in business would have, why would they upgrade? Or, you know, and then whenever they did finally have to upgrade, they'd be looking at the competition. They'd be looking at something else. So, big company, you know, once they establish things like connectors, you can't really start changing that. That's not a very smart thing to do. So, I don't know. But in any case, the Apple stuff just doesn't really excite me anymore. And so I don't see myself buying any new Apple products anytime soon. Kind of happy with what I have. I'm happy with this 17-inch MacBook Pro. Happy with my iPad. Happy with the iPod that I have. And very happy with this new Samsung Galaxy S3. So... So anyway, I want to talk a little bit about what is coming up. Of course, there's an election coming up. And it's getting closer and closer. But there's other things that are coming up too. Possibly World War III is coming up. Very possible. And it may well hinge on who becomes the next president of the United States. Now, there are people that are saying, well, I'm not going to vote. Or I'm going to go ahead and vote for Obama. I don't like Romney. Or I'm going to vote for Gary Johnson or whoever. Vote for, write in a name. Protest. I can tell you this much. If Obama gets back in, we're probably going to end up with World War III. But we will end up with concentration camps. We will end up probably with genocide, with a civil war of some sort. Don't know how what form it would take. But if he gets back in, we deserve it. We deserve it as a nation simply because enough people, you know, the election in 2008, enough people could be bamboozled into voting for him in the first place. We deserve the misery that he's already inflicted, and if he gets reelected, it's going to really get bad. Now, if let's say Romney wins, and I still think Romney's going to win. I've turned the media pretty much off. I do listen to Glenn Beck, and I listen to Rush Limbaugh, and I look at headlines on the internet, and I'll read an occasional article. But the mainstream media, they're traitors. Those people should, in a sane world, they would go to jail for what they're doing. And a lot of people in our current government would go to jail in a sane world. But let's say Romney gets in. Obama is already on a course to do as much damage as he possibly can. And, you know, Bernanke and the Federal Reserve, now they're just printing unlimited amounts of money. And they're downgrading the U.S. credit system. But they're printing money in hopes, you know, in a kind of a last-ditch effort, in hopes to kind of keep people asleep. Because we've already gone over the cliff. The world has already gone over the cliff. And right now they're just trying to keep things together a little longer, a little longer, a little longer. Even if Romney gets in, from a financial standpoint, we're going to go through hell. And we deserve that. We deserve it, by the way, too. But if Obama gets in, not only are we going to go through financial hell, we're going to go through social hell. There'll be blood running in the streets. And you're going to end up with concentration camps. Look at the history of virtually any country that loses its way. So just sitting on your hands or writing some other name in because you don't like Romney or what, that's not an excuse, and you're going to deserve what you get. You really will. You know, if you think about it, you die either because you deserve it or because you don't. And there's no other alternative. You either die because you deserve to die, or you die because you didn't deserve it. And there's no other choice. By the way, if you've got Dish Network, Glenn Beck is the Blaze TV. They changed the name of it from GBTV to the Blaze/TV. But the Blaze is now, if you've got Dish Network, the Blaze is now on channel 212 of Dish Network. And they've made a 24/7 channel, and they're adding new programming, and, you know, so that's available. If you've got Dish Network, that's on there. And it probably as soon it's going to start appearing on other satellite, you know, on DirecTV, and then probably cable systems as well. And it's going to be, it's a brand new 24/7 news network. But anyway, I've got an article here. Glenn Beck sent out some investigators from, you know, just some of his people. He sent them out to Massachusetts and to find out, you know, what stories are there about Mitt Romney. And so I'm going to read this article. The Real Mitt Romney: Beck Interviews People Whose Lives Have Been Touched by the GOP Nominee. On Friday evening, Glenn Beck interviewed people from Mitt Romney's past, including the Nixon family, who were comforted by the Republican presidential nominee following a horrific car accident that left two of its members quadriplegics. Also on the set was Bryce Clark, a man who, or mentioned by Romney, Ken Smith, a former director for a Boston shelter for homeless veterans, and Reed Fisher, whose home was damaged by wildfires. Candidate Mitt Romney is that he almost comes across as being too put together and restrained when it comes to showing emotion. While Ann Romney has provided much warmth and been a good focal point for campaign watchers seeking insight into the softer side of her husband, those whose lives have been touched and changed for the better by the GOP nominee are speaking out to share their personal stories of compassion, comfort, and support. Unlike the president, whose critics often cite the unusual nature of his seeming lack of friends, peers, colleagues, and girlfriends from the past, Romney's life appears to have been full of personal connections with everyday people who remember him fondly. In Beck's Dallas studio, they shared their very personal stories about Romney, painting a poignant and human picture of the presidential candidate. These are their stories. So I'm going to play the audio from these interviews. So, and I'm getting these off of the blaze.com. And so we'll start with the... this is the Nixon family.
Tonight, I want to start with the Nixon family. What happened to their children is everybody's worst nightmare. In 1995, Mom Cheryl Nixon and her husband Mark got word that four of their six children were in a terrible car accident. Their two sons, Rob and Reed, had their necks broken. They were both rendered quadriplegics. But what happened after that was a miracle. Cheryl and Mark Nixon are here with their three children that were in that car accident. Reed, Natalie, and Rob joins us from California. Who wants to tell the story first as a parent of what happened that night and what condition everybody was in?
The night of the accident?
Yeah, what happened to the family and how did everything change?
Our two oldest daughters were away at college. And the four were at this church youth activity, and they were coming home from that, and we got the call that they were in an accident. And so I called Mark at work, and he came from Boston, and I came from Western Massachusetts, and found that Reed and Rob were both paralyzed on ventilators with bruised hearts and collapsed lungs. And they were like the same injuries for both of them. We just couldn't believe it. And we had three different hospitals that our kids were in that night.
Oh, my gosh.
And so we didn't know what to do exactly, but we ended up where Reed and Rob were, and we spent several days there with them.
Your life forever changed.
Forever changed.
And their life forever changed.
Yes.
Okay. Now let's fast forward to the point where Mitt Romney comes into your life. Do you know him at all?
We know of him.
We know of him.
Yeah. Mitt, we knew he lived in Belmont, and he had been a prominent person in politics in Massachusetts up to that time. And we knew Mitt had been our state president.
Let me explain that in case if you're a Catholic, that's kind of almost like a cardinal or a bishop. Now, it's bigger than a bishop. It's more like a cardinal. He oversees a whole region of people. So was he your stake president then?
No, he had been released from that calling and as they periodically make changes.
So he's a regular schmo.
That's right.
And he's not serving in any official capacity. And you don't really... You've never met him.
We were not acquainted with each other.
What happens?
So the boys had been in rehab for over 6 months, and they were just arriving home late in the fall, and we were up to our first Christmas, and it was kind of a bleak time for us. I mean, this was a whole different way of what we're going to do at Christmas. Time, which had always been a big, big family time for us.
Oh, and here we had two sons who couldn't even open their own presents. We just didn't know what to do for them.
How are you guys financially at this time?
Well, fortunately, we had insurance, and I was a professor. I am a professor at Bentley University, and I had excellent medical coverage.
Okay,
but we didn't have anything extra at this point at all.
Okay.
So Mitt gave me a call at work and said, you know, I'd like to do something for Reed and Rob for Christmas. And I thought, well, gee, thank you. That's appreciated. And, you know, we had had numerous individuals who had helped us over those months. And people were very generous and very helpful, whatever they could be doing.
Sure.
And so it wasn't uncommon that people would choose to help us in mm-hmm. some way. And I guess what was surprising is that what Mitt asked was, well, I'd like to be able to come over to your home. And I thought, well, that was
pretty different than writing a check.
Right.
Absolutely.
So, Cheryl, what?
Yes, and so Christmas Eve day, they came over.
Anne and Mitt?
Anne and Mitt and the three sons that were at home.
Okay.
They came bearing huge boxes, wonderful gifts for our sons. And Mark hadn't told the boys, so they were totally surprised. And Reed, yeah. Go ahead.
It was amazing that all of a sudden we had a knock at the front door. My dad said that we were having gifts and some guests come over, but he never told us who it was. And all of a sudden it was the Romneys who, had been in the news. And
Rob, what happened? What did you experience when they got there? What did they do?
You know, it's kind of the same. It was just kind of initial shock. It was, and with the gifts, you know, the boxes, we just saw huge boxes coming in, and it was just the initial awestruck. And so it was an amazing surprise and everything. And they actually ended up opening up the boxes and helping us unwrap some stuff. And what it ended up being was my dad had mentioned to Mitt that Reed always used to beat me in stereo competitions, because I just had a little boombox that I used to use, and Reed had a nicer stereo. And so Mitt ended up getting me this ginormous stereo that was just
it was huge.
you were losing then.
Oh yes. Yeah.
I only have a couple of seconds left, but I want to get to this part. It wasn't just that one day, was it?
No. In fact, what was remarkable after that is that Mitt actually came and participated in road races that we had at Bentley University and other road races. He contributed to the to golf tournaments that we had for benefits. And then he pulled me aside. Really early on in this, he said, Mark, I want you to know that I will pay for Reed and Rob's entire college education. This is an expense you will not have to ever worry about.
This story's not been told, has it? You just wrote a book, In the Blink of an Eye, the Reed and Rob Nixon story. But you only touched on this. You didn't even tell it completely.
Not in as much detail as we're talking here.
Has anybody from the press called and asked for this question?
There's been a couple of requests.
Are you listed in the phone book? Because maybe they'd have a hard time finding you.
No, we would be happy to talk to anyone that has ever reached us.
Genuine guy.
Well, I'll tell you the more important part of the story, in this that's always touched me, and that is that it wasn't just his administrative assistant sending a big check, which would be
nice.
Would have been so appreciated. Yeah. But he shows up on Christmas Eve day, when I would have expected families to be in New Hampshire, skiing in Utah, down the Caribbean, on their own vacation. And yet, what are they doing on Christmas Eve? He comes to the home, and it's Mitt and it's his sons. So the message is, this is what the Romneys do on Christmas. They're out, instead of vacationing, they're at visiting the needy.
Well, geez, now I feel guilty. That's not really.
That's actually, to me, has been more important to me than the financial help he gave.
And okay. He's done it again and again and again personally.
With you guys.
Yes, he hasn't. After the initial experience of showing up, he didn't check that off his list and say, "I did my duty," which would have been phenomenal. He has year after year shown up at 5K races to run the event and participate.
Well, I want to thank you guys for coming on, and I want to apologize because I hear we sent you American Airlines. I don't know who on my staff did that. And I hear it didn't go well for you.
Well, we made it here.
You made it. You made it. All right. Thank you very much. God bless you.
Thank you.
Back in just a second.
Okay, so that was the Nixon family. That I listened through that. That's quite a remarkable story. And so next, the next one we're going to listen to is, the fellow's name is Reed Fisher. After his home was damaged in a wildfire in 2007, Reed Fisher got an unexpected hand from then presidential candidate Romney. So this is Glenn Beck interviewing Reed Fisher.
Now I'm going to introduce you to Reed Fisher. His home was damaged during the wildfires in San Diego in 2007. This one was during campaign, and the callous among us, the cynics among us, would say, well, he's doing that because it's during a campaign. But you've heard the foundation of things that nobody knows about, and it's a life like this. Reed Fisher was in the middle of a fire. And how did you come across Mitt Romney?
Well, I should say it sort of starts with his son. Matt Romney lives in our general area, and he knew my son, Ethan. After the fires, the community came through and cleaned a lot of our lots off pretty much. And we weren't allowed back in our homes right away, but when we were, they came through and cleaned, you know, the yards and tried to remove the debris. Mm-hmm. But one day I got a call, because we were out of our home, by the way, because repairs were still in progress, and we were friends that arranged for us to be in another location. But I got a call from Matt, and he said, Reed, we want to come over and do something to help you. And I thought about it, and I said, you know, Matt, they've come through and removed most of the debris. I'd had a lot of landscape that was burned and charred. But there was this one tree, one big pine tree that was in our very front, that was torched during the fire. Well, when they came through, that tree could not be removed because it was going to take a lot more effort to dig out that stump. So I thought to myself, I'm not going to deny somebody the opportunity to help, and I needed the help.
Right.
And so I said, sure, Matt, bring the guys. He wanted to bring some other friends and come on over, and we'll set up that date.
Was this one of those, because I have to tell you, I'm probably the worst person here, because I'm the kind of guy who will call and say, do you need any help? And they'll say, no, I really don't. And I on the other end going, was this a sincere offer to help?
More than sincere. Okay. He pressed, you know, he wanted to, I could sense in him that Matt, his son, had this feeling of, we want to help. I want to help and okay. do something. So we set the date for them to come. And that morning, I went off early to get some, we in California, we like burritos. So I got some breakfast burritos to bring back to the guys that were coming. Well, when I drove back to the house, as I approached the house, there was a big black Suburban at the top of the street, and we probably think that we don't know for sure, but the guy in the white jacket out the street should have alerted me that there was somebody different on our street, probably Secret Service. I'm not sure to this day, but as I came down to the house, there in the hole were these four men just sawing and chopping and digging at this big tree stump.
Surrounded by press?
Oh, no. No cameras. It's not a press event. But as I said to others, one of them was at that time a candidate for President of the United States of America. It was Matt's father, Mitt Romney. And how this came about is it just happened by coincidence that Mitt was in Southern California for some meetings. I think he was probably visiting Matt and seeing his grandchildren. And Matt told me that morning he'd been out for a run already. And when they were coming over to my house, Matt, you know, said, I'm going to help this fellow. And Mitt said, I don't have to be to my meetings till later. I'll come, too. And he did. Well, the thing that I'll always remember is no one had ever seen Mitt with his hair mussed up. But you have the pictures. And they, you know, there was nobody working harder that day around that stump than Mitt. And I'd like to say this one point that really brings that out is in the middle of all of this, I walked over to Mitt and offered him some little, you know, breakfast like I had done the others. And he just looked at me and said, maybe later, got to get this stump out. That told me something right away about a man that could focus. Then there was another instance with his son that I really want to share with your audience, and that is, Mitt was working with his boy, and in one moment, as I stood there helping, he hollered at Matt and said, hey, Matt, get over here with that tool, get under this, through it, we got to cut this. And I saw at that moment, this is not just a presidential candidate. This is a father who knows how to work with his son and who knows how to come and help a neighbor.
I have to tell you, I feel so guilty after this show. I feel like the worst slug in the world. And second, I mean, I have been very hard on Mitt Romney, and he's a decent man. He is a decent man. Yeah. It doesn't mean that his policies are necessarily the ones that everybody in the world has to agree with, but he is a decent man. Any reason besides politics that this stuff isn't told? I mean, this is...
Politics is the reason it's not told. Well, totally, in my mind. You know, I think that, you know, there's probably 100 reasons, but I think that people who... you tell these kinds of stories, it's hard to believe. You know, it's hard to swallow.
Matt made it very clear when they left that day. Again, there were no cameras. We have pictures because I called my wife quickly on my cell phone and said, you better come over here and see.
Anybody cover this?
Not at that day,
right.
But it's been shown since then.
Okay.
But no. And Matt made it clear, this is not a publicity. This was not done for publicity. I just wanted to come help, and Dad was here. And Matt said something else to me. He said, thank you, Reed. I said, thank you for coming to help. And he said, thank you, Reed. This is something that Dad used to get us boys up to go sometimes on weekend mornings, and we don't get to do this that much anymore. Thank you
guys for sharing. Back in a minute.
Okay, so that was Glenn Beck interviewing Reed Fisher, and again, that, you know, that's an amazing story, and I think it really tells you who Mitt Romney is. You know, these are the kinds of things that we should all be doing, and just think how busy Mitt Romney is, and yet he's finding time to do it. And you know, the average person, we should be doing these things, and we have no time, you know, yet somehow he's able to make time, and it's really quite amazing.
Okay, I want to I want to introduce you to three guys, but I'm and each of them have a different story, and I want to start with Bryce Clark, who is, would you consider Mitt a mentor, or at some point a mentor?
Yeah.
You're Mormon.
Yes.
He was your stake president. I talked about this a little while ago. That's kind of like a cardinal. You're Catholic, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a cardinal, and being an alcoholic and a Mormon is a big deal. I know, because I think we may be the only two alcoholics in the whole faith, but at least the one that talks about it. And you were struggling with alcoholism. Your father is a big wig. Your father runs BYU Idaho. And you went in to see the stake president.
Yeah, I mean, so I had known Mitt Romney my whole life. He'd been my home teacher, obviously a prominent guy, and it was time for me to go on a mission at age 19. So I went in to talk to Mitt.
Did anybody know you were out of control except you?
No.
Okay. Even your dad?
They suspected something.
Okay.
But I went in and I completely lied. Lied my way through the whole interview. Was ready to go. And then one night realized that that had been a huge mistake and I needed to make amends. And I knew if I didn't do it right then, I would never do it. So I went to my parents' room and I said, I need to talk to Mitt Romney right now. It was like 11 o'clock at night. They called him. He said, send him over. Went over to his house, you know, walking up his driveway, like just feeling, like you said, my dad was prominent. And I knew this was good. First of all, I knew that, like, it wasn't just alcoholism. I'd gotten into drugs and other stuff, too. Like, there was no way I was going on a mission
right
after I told Mitt what was going on.
Right. And you also know in that culture, that's really a big deal. That's like,
yeah.
You're the devil.
Yeah.
You had a beer.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're way beyond.
I'm way beyond
you're
that.
You're El Diablo.
Exactly.
Oh, got it.
And I'm walking up there just expecting that Mitt Romney's just going to confirm all that and we'll go through the what we have to go through, and he'll lay down the law, and, you know,
that'll be it.
And that's not what happened. And the way that he handled the situation that night changed my life.
What did he say?
Well, first of all, I mean, it was, you know, he's still in his work clothes, you know, in his slippers. He takes me into his den and he sat me down. And most times when I've been in these things, I usually just kind of zone out and I just kind of, it's like you're ticking off, you know, each point and I just want to get through it. And he said, I know what you're going to say. You don't even have to tell me. He said, I know. And he said, we'll take care of the mission. You're not going. And I said, I understand. But he was like, I don't want to talk about that. And he got right down into my face and he said, I want you to know that you're not alone. He said, I will be here for you, but you're not the only person that struggles. And he said, I want you to stop thinking about yourself, because I know you're doing this to yourself, as a bad person. He said, you're not measured by how many good things you do and how many bad things you do. He said, this is how we're measured. Are we trying to improve? And he said, you being here tonight qualifies you as a saint. And then he spoke to me for about an hour, shared some scriptures and different thoughts. And I walked away from his house back to my car, just filled with hope. And my life didn't change overnight, but it changed my paradigm, how I looked at myself, how I looked at other people. And the next 2 years were kind of hard because I'm the Mormon guy who's 19 that's not on a mission.
Oh, yeah.
Whenever Mitt Romney saw me in public, his arm was around me. He would go out of his way to come over to me, shake my hand, and make me feel welcome.
Let me read. May I read this?
Yeah.
Have you shared this with anybody? Has anybody the press called you?
I did share it with the New York Times.
Did they print it?
Not the letter.
Yeah. Here's the letter that Mitt wrote in his own handwriting. Bryce, you are a blessed choice person. The Lord loves you. Your life will be filled with large measure of happiness. Your worth is not measured by the total of your sins, but of good deeds, and it is measured whether you are striving to improve. This measure, you are a saint. I look forward to seeing you best, Mitt.
Yeah, and he reiterated that those two ideas. It's not where you are.
Did he just kind of hug you and then move on, or has he, because you refer to him now as like a mentor.
I mean, from that time on until, like, I didn't come back to the church right away.
Took me some time.
But he was always, this isn't the only letter that he wrote me. And he would come see me. I mean, even way after he was the stake president, he would still do that. And then when my first child was born, he came to my church where I was to be in the blessing of my child. And, you know, I've moved on since then. I don't bump into Mitt Romney all the time, you know, but it's one of those things where someone gives you an hour of their time, and he'd been there for me in my childhood, but it literally changed my life.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll travel to you and find out how Mitt Romney impacted your life.
Okay, so that was Glenn Beck interviewing Bryce Clark. And so the next one I'm going to play is Glenn Beck interviewing Ken Smith.
All right, I want to go to another remarkable story. This one is with Ken Smith. He's the former director of the New England Center for the Homeless Veterans. And he had kind of a run-in with Mitt Romney while he was running for Senate, right?
Yes, in 1994, Mitt Romney was running for Senate against Ted Kennedy.
And this is a bad. This starts out as a bad story. He makes a huge gaffe.
Well, yeah, he kind of does. This particular shelter, which is huge, it's an old VA hospital right in downtown Boston. It's got 500 to 600 guys living in it who are homeless. Yeah. They're all registered to vote. So we asked the candidates to come in. First, Ted Kennedy came in, spent, you know, 30, 40 minutes looking around. Mm-hmm. Then, a couple of days later, Mitt Romney comes in. And you know, it's kind of like this. There's a lot of TV cameras. There's mm-hmm. newspapers. He's got staff. It's a circus. But the first thing Mitt Romney did, he sat down at a table and said, can I look at the books? And I said, absolutely. You know, we're a charity. Come on. So he sat for about 30, 35, 40 minutes and just went through the books of the institution. Then he asked for a tour, and this is a very big place. This is, you know, 200,000 square foot old hospital. So we brought him through the entire facility. He was very impressed. And now it's time to leave. So he's at the front door, and he's telling me, you know, Ken, this is a very incredible program. And, you know, you're not warehousing people, and I'm very proud of it. And but, you know, what's your biggest problem today? And so I said, milk. And he looked at me and said, milk? Well, what do you mean milk? So I said, well, the biggest problem is I give each of these veterans a pint of milk at dinner and a pint of milk at breakfast. I have over 500 of them, so it's 1,000 pints of milk a day, 7,000 pints of milk a week. And so I'm in trouble with, you know, the milk bill. And so he pulled me aside and he said, well, you know, maybe you should teach homeless veterans how to milk cows.
And, not a smart, with TV cameras there?
TV cameras, newspaper reporters, yeah, everyone, then he leaves. Some reporter comes over and says, did he just tell you to have veterans milk cows? And I said, yeah.
But you, it was a joke, or was he serious?
At the time, I didn't really know.
Okay.
I don't, you know, he's got kind of a strange funny bone, I guess. So
yeah, no, he's hard to read. Yeah.
But, the guy is a business guy. He was laser focused on the programs we did. So, so now the newspapers get it. It's a big deal. And the next day, you know, they're killing him. So he called me and said, you know, number one, I apologize. I own this. I did this. And I'm so sorry that I've done something to affect your program in a negative way, if at all possible. And, you know, I'll see what I can do to try and help you out with your milk problem.
Okay.
And I kind of, yeah, okay.
Whatever, politician.
Following Friday, our milk guy shows up. He offloads 7,000 pints of milk. I mean, he got 7,000 pints of milk and gives us the bill, and it's half price. So I think, wow, that's great. And didn't think about it again. The next milk delivery, it's the same thing. The following milk delivery, a month, 2 months, 3 months. I'm like, wow. And I would ask the milk guy, who was a veteran, like, who's doing this? And he's, I can't tell you. And this went on for not 3 months, 6 months, or a year. It went on for 2 years.
Holy cow.
At the end of this two-year program, the milkman retired. It was like his last day. He was coming in to deliver the milk today. It's his last day, and we pulled him aside and said, John, you know, who's been buying the milk? You know, who's been doing this? And he said, Romney. So I wrote a little note, thank you very much. There was never any press about it. There was never any press releases about it. Romney's generosity has helped tens of thousands of veterans who are homeless, who've been through this facility, with nourishment. And, you know, the milk carton said the name of the milk company. It didn't say donated by Mitt Romney or USAID.
He didn't want it to be known.
Not at all. And not even to me. So that told me something about him as a man. And you know, subsequently, a couple of years later, he becomes governor. He becomes the governor. And at a meeting... once a year, the charity has to go into the government and show their budget. First, the government says, here's how much we're going to give you, and then you say, here's how much we need. Well, when it's, here's how much we're going to give you, you look at the food part of it, and the food part of it was doubled. So the guy remembered that
you were struggling.
Totally. And so, as a business guy, he's like a laser beam. You know, I think earlier I heard you say, you know, he can fix the stuff. He can fix the engine. He is the mechanic that's going to fix an engine. And he cares about the American veteran, you know, in a way that's very similar to the story you've already heard. He doesn't ask for anything in return. He never. If I didn't tell you this, you wouldn't know.
And anybody print this story before? Anybody coming, calling you and trying to print this story? No. And you're a Catholic, right?
I'm a Catholic. I'm a parishioner of Our Lady of Mercy Church in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. So, and you know, my family and I are not, and veterans are non-denominational.
Right. Yeah, I know.
So, you know.
I know. I'm only asking that question because I know that somebody's going to say, "Oh, well, you know."
This is all about being Mormon. Mormon.
Yeah.
No, and you know, he didn't do this because I'm a Catholic, and he didn't do it because I'm not a Mormon. I think he did this because in his character, he saw this need, felt bad because somebody had kind of pulled the covers on his funny bone, and said, you know what, I'm going to make this right.
And most of us, I contend, would be too afraid to call you in the first place because it would just let it go away, which would lead to your problem and my problem. But the rest of us probably would have only called to apologize and then said, I did my part, or maybe one week, but
possibly,
certainly not 2 years and without anybody knowing. Thank you so much.
Okay, so that was the final one. I think I haven't actually watched the entire episode yet. It was Friday's episode, but there were, I think he had mentioned on the radio program that there were going to be 8 different stories, 8 different people he was going to interview, but all they have on the, you know, that I was able to get off of the Blaze website was 4. So, but those are inspiring, and it really tells you what kind of guy Mitt Romney is. And quite frankly, someone with that kind of character is something that we should all be aspiring to. You know, that's really inspirational. He's really an inspirational figure. But he's very quiet about it. He doesn't, you know, and that there are a lot of people that are generous and so on and so forth. And most people, you know, aren't bragging about what they're doing. They don't brag about this or brag about that. You shouldn't, you know, because if you're bragging about it, then that, if you know, if there's someone that's bragging, well, I did this and I gave that, and, you know, they make a big public deal out of it, or they just make a big deal out of it, kind of a showy thing to their friends, it's all fake. And it's all phony. You know, if it's genuine, you're not going to be bragging about it. So, but the news media is trying to create a perception of Romney as, you know, he's just some, you know, evil business guy and so on and so forth. And it's pretty obvious that he's not. You know, there's an entirely different side to him, and you know, so the idea, well, I don't like him. Well, why don't you like him? Well, you know, it's because the news media has created a perception. They create a perception shell around people. And so, but in any case, like I was saying before, if you don't, you know, if you vote for the wrong guy, or if you write a name in or whatever else, which is the same as voting for Obama, you know, and Obama wins, Obama gets back in, there's going to be real hell to pay. Now, there's going to be hell to pay otherwise. I don't think people realize, you know, this printing money, you know, that they've been doing is serious. It's very serious. Why do you think the price of gas has gone up? Why do you think, you know, even in a rotten economy, the price, you know, the price of gas is up, you know, it's more than doubled in the past 3.5 years. Why do you think the price of food is going up? And it's not just the drought. It's because of the inflation, and so they're printing money right now, and then they've downgraded the United States credit again, the credit rating. The Federal Reserve is buying our own, you know, its own debt. You know, it's buying the country's debt. You know, that's insane. That's like a snake eating itself. So they're corrupting the money. They're corrupting the money is simply a transfer system. Money is simply a means of transferring value from you know, goods and services from one person to another. It's just a, you know, it's just a unit of value, and they're corrupting it. They corrupt that as they've corrupted all of these people that won't work, people that aren't producing anything. They're just sitting around, you know, watching Oprah or whatever it is that they do. And we have more of those people that are just sitting around kind of non-productive overhead, even if they're working for the government. Working for the government. You know, saying, oh, well, I'm producing. No, you're not. You're overhead. You're not producing anything real. Now, some overhead's necessary. Firemen are necessary. Policemen are necessary. The military's necessary. The courts are necessary. They don't function very well sometimes, but they're necessary. That's necessary overhead. But all these bureaucracies are not necessary. They're just parasites. And their goal is to turn as many people as possible into parasites that rely on, you know, it's like a parasite relying on another parasite. And you corrupt the monetary system, the system of transfer, value transfer, because otherwise it would be a barter economy. You corrupt those credits that you use to transfer value from one person to another. You corrupt that, and then nobody's going to work. Nobody's going to be producing anything. You know, in a modern society with a division of labor, let's see how long the average person, especially a person living in a city, or anybody, how long are you going to be able to survive if somebody's not producing food and bringing it to you, making it available? If that breaks, if that system breaks, there's millions of people are going to starve. And if you have kids, you just shit all over their future, pardon my French. Mitt Romney is not perfect. Nobody's perfect. But at least if he's elected, if Mitt Romney is elected, at least there's a chance that we can survive. At least there's a chance that things can be turned around. But we're going to pay for our lack of character. We're going to pay for the fact that, you know, that Obama was elected in the first place. That people could be so easily bamboozled. That has a cost, and it's going to be a steep cost. So one way or another, our character is about to be put to the test, and it's going to be, what I'm saying is, it's going to be a severe test. In America, we've pretty much all lived lives of just, you know, leisure, easy lives, cushy lives. We have no idea of what real hardship is. We have no clue. We literally have no clue. We've lived almost like in an anesthetized bubble. You know, just kind of anesthetized on a soft couch, having stuff handed to us. Living in a dream world. So we're going to be put to the test. And it's going to be a severe test. How severe sort of depends on who wins in November. So, anyway, better be cutting this off, see if I can get headed to bed. Hope everyone is having a great week, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.
If I wanted America to fail, to follow, not lead, to suffer, not prosper, to despair, not dream, I'd start with energy. I'd cut off America's supply of cheap, abundant energy. I couldn't take it by force, so I'd make Americans feel guilty about using the energy that heats their homes, fuels their cars, runs their businesses, and powers their economy. I'd make cheap energy expensive, so that expensive energy would seem cheap. I would empower unelected bureaucrats to all but outlaw America's most abundant sources of energy. After banning its use in America, I'd make it illegal for American companies to ship it overseas. If I wanted America to fail, I'd use their schools to teach one generation of Americans that their factories and their cars will cause a new ice age. And I'd muster a straight face so I could teach the next generation that they're causing global warming. When it's cold out, I'd call it climate change instead. I'd imply that America's cities and factories could run on wind power and wishes. I'd teach children how to ignore the hypocrisy of condemning logging, mining, and farming while having roofs over their heads, heat in their homes, and food on their tables. I would never teach children that the free market is the only force in human history to uplift the poor, establish the middle class, and create lasting prosperity. Instead, I demonize prosperity itself so that they will not miss what they will never have. If I wanted America to fail, I would create countless new regulations and seldom cancel old ones that would be so complicated that only bureaucrats, lawyers, and lobbyists could understand them. That way, small businesses with big ideas wouldn't stand a chance. And I would never have to worry about another Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, or Steve Jobs. I would ridicule as flat earthers those who urge them to lower energy costs by increasing supply. And when the evangelists of common sense try to remind people about the laws of supply and demand, I'd enlist a sympathetic media to drown them out. If I wanted America to fail, I would empower unaccountable bureaucracy seated in a distant capital to bully Americans out of their dreams and their property rights. I'd send federal agents to raid guitar factories for using the wrong kind of wood. I'd force homeowners to tear down their own homes built on their own land. I'd make it almost impossible for farmers to farm, miners to mine, loggers to log, and builders to build. Because I don't believe in free markets, I'd invent false ones. I'd devise fictitious products like carbon credits and trade them in imaginary markets. I'd convince people that this would create jobs and be good for the economy. If I wanted America to fail, for every concern, I'd invent a crisis. And for every crisis, I'd invent the cause, like shutting down entire industries and killing tens of thousands of jobs in the name of saving spotted owls. And when everyone learned the stunning irony that the owls were victims of their larger cousins and not people, it would already be decades too late. If I wanted America to fail, I'd make it easier to stop commerce than to start it, easier to kill jobs than create them, more fashionable to resent success than to seek it. When industries seek to create jobs, I'd file lawsuits to stop them, and then I'd make taxpayers pay for my lawyers. If I wanted America to fail, I would transform the environmental agenda from a document of conservation to an economic suicide pact. I would concede entire industries to our economic rivals by imposing regulations that cost trillions. and celebrate those who preach environmental austerity in public while indulging a lavish lifestyle in private. I convince Americans that Europe has it right and that America has it wrong. If I wanted America to fail, I would prey on the goodness and the decency of ordinary Americans. I would only need to convince them that all of this is for the greater good. If I wanted America to fail, I suppose I wouldn't change a thing.